Investors Chronicle.
Hello and welcome to the IC Interviews. I'm Dave Baxter, the Deputy Personal Finance Editor on the IC, and today I'm joined by two guests. Today we have Lynn Hutchinson, Head of Passives at Charles Stanley, and Bri Leitao, Morningstar's Passive Strategies Analyst. Both Lynn and Bri have kindly served this year as panelists on the IC's top 50 ETFs list, something we've been putting the finishing touches on in the last couple of weeks. As we put out our latest list of the best and most interesting ETFs as building blocks for your portfolio, I thought there's no better time to discuss the biggest developments in the industry in the last year or so. From ESG to thematic investments and even the value rally of the last half year or so, there have been some really huge market developments that have fed into the ETF space. So both of you, thank you very much for joining. As I've said, of course, we've had lots going on in the markets, lots of that feeding through into the ETF industry. So I thought first up, it'd be interesting just to put you on the spot and ask, you know, what are the kind of interesting developments you've been seeing in recent months? You know, are there any new ETFs that have been catching your eye? Are there any trends that you think investors need to be keeping an eye on themselves? What's been most interesting?
Shall I start? So there's been a number of new themes that have popped up. I think the main drive this year has been around clean energy. And I think that's been for the past 18 months now. Now, we've seen a new product launched this year from L&G, which is hydrogen ETF. Again, it focuses around the whole clean energy hype in the markets, but it's still very early days for hydrogen. If you look at, so it's really important to look at your theme that you're trying to track and make sure you understand what you're investing in as first and foremost. But with hydrogen theme, you know, it's still very early days for green hydrogen, which is produced using zero emission renewable sources. So a lot of the companies within this basket, hydrogen basket, are more focused towards the grey hydrogen. So, and the purity of the theme is still only 20 to 30% of hydrogen. So it's still very low. It's been popular. So the assets have gone up to around $460 million since its launch earlier this year. But again, and a lot of the companies included in the basket, it's not their main business revenue. So look at the theme, look at the index and the methodology and see how much revenue is required to be included in these type of themes. So again, you know, it's been really popular, but whether it's the right course of action for your clean energy focus, I'm not so sure.
I think that's a really interesting issue, I guess, we've seen elsewhere. So if you jump across the pond, you've had the, you know, everyone's been talking about ARK in the last year, and you've had to, they came out with the kind of space-related ETF, and lots of people noted it had things like Netflix in it. And it's almost kind of you could argue it's kind of a placeholder until that industry develops. I mean, what do you guys think about that, I guess, question of kind of whether you invest in these thematic ETFs early? You know, do you go in, or does it make sense to kind of just let the theme mature a bit more?
Yeah, I'm happy to take that one. I think with the ARK, you know, an issue that they have is a lot of the cross holdings that their funds have. I think exactly as you said, these themes are very specific, and without over investing into some of these companies, you know, when you start talking about inflating the price, et cetera, companies like Netflix are really just placeholders, exactly like you said. I think that the more particular you go into a theme, I think this is when you start to worry about portfolio concentration, too much money. I mean, the ARK funds have just so much money behind them. It's just a challenge around managing those flows.
And Lynn, you mentioned the clean energy space. That's, I suppose that's probably been one of the most controversial areas for ETFs in the last year, with the iShares fund. It's had some issues with pulling in so much money that it was perhaps owning too much of some of its kind of smaller companies, and then they had to overhaul the index. I guess it's a question for either of you, but are there any kind of key considerations investors need to be thinking about when looking at these clean energy ETFs? Because we've seen a few more names come into the space, and now it does seem like there's a decent amount of choice there.
Yeah, there's lots of choice, and you know, they focus around clean energy, but they're not all holding the same equities as well. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned the iShares Global Clean Energy. That was focused more towards the small and mid-cap range. It got to such a huge size that it couldn't cope with any more inflows and was pushing the value of the small cap. So now it's changed, and the purity was 100%. It's now dropped to around 70 or 80%. In my view, it's in a better position to take new inflows now. So you've got other clean energy ETFs that have recently launched, and they're still more focused towards the small and mid-cap. But as they mature, or as more flows come in, these will also have to change their index as well. So we'll see that with a lot of themes that are coming through, that it's still early days for a lot of them, but they will have to mature with the market as well and with the investor flows. So you will see themes and their indices change as times go on. It's important to realize that these are very volatile as well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's not something like an MSCI World Market Cap ETF where you don't see huge movements, performance movements on a day-to-day basis, but these themes tend to have big movements. So if your tech's not doing so well in a large cap, these will be hit even more because they've got a bit of tech exposure as well to the theme.
Yeah, I suppose there are two kind of interesting points there. One is some critics might say that there's perhaps a lot more timing involved in some of these thematic names. I mean, sticking with the iShares Global Clean Energy Fund, you know, if you'd invested at certain points last year, you're actually still, I think, sitting on quite significant gain. But then a lot of the investors who came in late last year or early this year have had a much more difficult time. And then I guess another point you're perhaps alluding to is something I've stressed in this year's list is just, it does seem like you have to do so much more due diligence on thematics, and it doesn't stop. You have to constantly watch to see if, you know, the index is being overhauled or there's some kind of problem happening in that industry.
No, exactly that. I mean, it's really this sort of three-staged problem with each sort of level, you know, effectively requiring fulfillment to the previous level. So, I mean, you've got to make sure that you start with the right theme. Is this going to be a theme or an idea? Whether it's clean energy or robotics or what have you, is this going to be something that's going to persist and be around in the next 5 to 10 years? After that, then you have to consider whether or not you have the right fund. Is this a fund that's adequately capturing this theme? And then once you've got those two squared away, the last thing is finally, is it the right time? Is this the right time to buy? I mean, exactly like you said, the investors who got in early into those funds, you know, are still sitting on gains, but perhaps the ones who came a bit later to the party are maybe not so happy today.
Yeah,
and we've got a slew of historic evidence now. You know, whether it's, you know, I suppose the .com bubble. You can even look at more modern themes today, like Bitcoin, robotics.
But if you look at the iShares Clean Energy ETF was set up around 2007-2008, and investors only really made a profit at the beginning around the beginning of 2020. So if you were in early in that theme, you sat in that theme losing money for many years before it became more topical. So these are the things you have to consider as well when you mention if you're going in too early.
And are there any, I suppose, kind of focusing on the composition of thematic ETFs, are there any key things to look for? And equally, are there any kind of providers that have stood out for, you know, having quite a good approach to putting together thematic ETFs?
Yeah, so I think the main things to look out for, obviously, issues around portfolio concentration. It seems to be this trade-off between, am I adequately capturing a theme versus is my portfolio sound in its construction? Is there adequate diversification? Is it too concentrated or top heavy? I think that's the main thing. In terms of asset managers or providers who are notable, I suppose FunEck might be worth a shout out. They're very much a US house. They specialize in ETFs and thematics, and they have a fair range. They seem to strike a good balance here. They're looking to gain a foothold in Europe, expanding operations this year, I suppose, yeah.
That'll be interesting when they come out, actually. We don't have any big issues that are specifically focused on thematics at the moment. Global X came to Europe last year. They've started launching a couple of thematics which look interesting. We've seen it across, HAN ETFs are also launching some niche products that have a theme attached to it, but nothing too specific in terms of individual providers, I'd say, yet.
Yeah. I suppose it'd be interesting to see as more products come out and you can compare the kind of methodologies and how they deal with those funds. I guess one other question on thematics, and perhaps really in this chat, I need a kind of big active advocate shouting me down, but this is one area where selectivity is really important. I mean, is there a strong argument for how would you deal with the criticisms? I'm sure there are criticisms that you can't do thematics in a kind of passive format.
I'd say to look at the methodology. So the methodology is really important. It's accessible for most of the ETFs, and it gives you a good overview of how much revenue. So a lot of them will look at revenue to themes under 50% of their revenue of the overall company. That's low. So you look for something that's got a larger revenue attached to the theme, like the iShares Global Clean Energy has. So that helps to focus where you're looking more at the purity of the theme, I'd say.
So another, really big story in the fund space that has fed into the ETF space has, of course, been ESG. Can't really get away from talking about ESG lately. It's been, quite a boon for active fund providers. What kind of activity have we seen in the ETF space, say in the last year, the last 18 months or so?
So in terms of ETF fund launches, it's been a spectrum of products that have come out. It's on the lighter end, if you will, it's been ESG screen products, which offer simple exclusions. They keep tracking error to a minimum. And then on the other end, you've got funds that expand on this. Their methodologies try to, also offer exclusions, but alongside that, perhaps work towards a goal of, say, low carbon or low CO2 emissions, where they'll typically rank a universe from best to worst in terms of CO2 emissions, and they'll exclude, say, the bottom 20%. These funds have their place, I suppose, when it comes to So these funds have their place when it comes to investor demand. If you are trying to keep tracking error to a region, at a minimum, while still ticking the ESG box, the lighter screen products are definitely for you. But if you don't mind the tracking error and you are looking to make a bit more of a socially conscious allocation, then products like the MSCI SRI range of are definitely for you.
Yeah, we've this year, I suppose, one change we've made in the top 50 ETFs list I've discussed with both of you is we've moved from some of those lighter ESG names. We kind of originally thought of those as perhaps a stepping stone, and we've now moved into the stricter ones using variants of the MSCI SRI indices. But yes, it is, I suppose, a thing I've noticed that's quite interesting is you are getting that kind of sometimes quite serious deviation from the parent index like the S&P 500 or the FTSE. For example, in the US, you sometimes you're moving away from things like the FANG stocks. So I suppose that's kind of quite a big thing to be aware of. But are we, are we, in terms of, I suppose, kind of where providers are going, and I don't know if you have any kind of ideas of demand as well, but are we seeing people showing more interest in those kind of stricter ESG funds versus the, you know, what we might call the lighter options?
Yeah. So people are definitely becoming, I suppose, more cognizant of the ESG screened funds. I think they sound great on paper, but over time, people have realized that, yes, while tracking errors at a minimum, if I look at ESG metrics for my portfolio, they're not necessarily improved. I mean, we have a slew of ESG ratings at Morningstar, but whether you use ours or whether you use, say, MSCI's or whoever, you know, sometimes it's not clear that your ESG profile has improved. If you go from, say, an S&P 500 to, say, an S&P 500 ESG or ESG screened. And I think when investors have to explain to their end clients sometimes, you know, yes, you've invested in this, but, you know, in terms of real material outcome, there hasn't been too much of a change, then perhaps that can raise question marks. And that's perhaps where a deeper, you know, dive into ESG is needed. I think it also depends on which region you're in. So I think if you take a US equity index and you look at its ESG metrics and you apply an ESG methodology to it, you're going to see a lot less of an improvement than if you did the same thing in emerging markets, for example, where with emerging markets, you're probably starting at a lower bar in terms of ESG profile. And then, you know, the bang for your buck that you get in terms of adding an ESG screen or a methodology or something or what have you, you know, it goes a lot further in terms of turning around your profile, whether that's CO2 output or governance.
Yeah. Are there any other regions as well where you would say going down the ESG route is making a bigger difference?
I would say that those are the two ends of the spectrum, really. I mean, within that, you can talk about developed markets versus emerging. Then you can go, you know, from, say, US to, say, China. Then from that, you can go to maybe, you know, Europe versus LATAM or India.
I suppose one interesting market for ESG, and you're seeing a few more options in terms of ETFs now, is the UK, given the composition of the market. One point I was going to raise that you see in the UK, some of those UK funds, is you do still sometimes get some names that perhaps you wouldn't, you know, an ESG lover wouldn't necessarily expect in there, like Rio Tinto, for example. And then if you go over to some of those US funds, it's been noted that Tesla is kind of in the top 10, which some might question. Is that just the kind of a problem that we can't get away from in terms of those stocks going into the methodology, or do you expect kind of further evolution there?
Yeah, so you're absolutely right. So you can find, you know, some quote unquote shockers in these, especially when you think of these as ESG funds. You know, why is Rio Tinto in my portfolio? But I think it's worth going back to the building blocks of these methodologies to remember that while they try to add these ESG screens or filters or methodologies, what they do try to do is limit active risk when it comes to sector bets. So they try to stay as sector neutral as possible. So a lot of these methodologies, the wording is, you know, we aim to exclude the bottom 50%, or we aim to invest in the top 25% per sector. So they want to keep the sector weights the same. And so what ends up happening is they will still be investing in, you know, CO2 intensive industries, whether it's energy or utilities or industrials, but they will be investing in the best, if you will.
Yeah. Yeah. So even if some might call it the best of a bad bunch, it's kind of
exactly
choosing those top names. Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, if you do want a product that absolutely excludes those, I guess this is where we start to have the conversation of active versus passive when it comes to ESG.
Yeah. Yeah.
And also SRI, because SRI delves deeper into it as well. Less focus on the sector neutrality as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
I personally think the European markets become too saturated with ESG products. I think it, as an investor, they're very confusing. I believe you need to delve deeper into the methodology, into the fact sheets. I just feel there's too many. You know, if Amundi do end up, you know, acquiring Lyxor, then Lyxor and Amundi are quite big in the ESG provider products. And what's going to happen there? We've got duplicates. So there's going to be closures maybe. So investors are actually going to be, you know, left sitting with CGT losses or gains, having to move into different products. I just think it's become too saturated, European market. I think UK investors are less concerned over ESG than European investors as well. So while the market's much bigger for ESG in Europe, the UK is less so. It is moving more towards that structure, but it's less so. And there's just too many products available.
I suppose another, on the other side of that, a big criticism of ESG is that, you know, everyone's got very excited about it and they like talking about it. It's very interesting. But is the demand actually there? Like, are we seeing kind of demand to match all of this proliferation of different variants of products?
I think in terms of flow, certainly. I think when it comes to, you know, is this something that's coming from the industry or is this something that's organic and client-led? I think it goes both ways. I think we hear conflicting rhetoric sometimes from asset managers that we're seeing huge demand for our products, but also, you know, there's definitely, there's a need for investor education. This is the term that gets thrown around, investor education. And for me, that stands as a bit of a, you know, it's either one or the other type thing. Is this organic or is it not? Or is it not? But there definitely has been the support in terms of flows. I think as, you know, regulation begins to lead the discussion, you know, we were talking about SFDR. I think that can also help to, you know, push the path of least resistance in favor of ESG products.
Sorry, go on.
Yeah, sorry. I was just going to say, you know, I absolutely echo those thoughts when it comes to product saturation. I think over the last year or two, we started off with the light touch products being a bit more favorable. And then we sort of started to see it within the last year, this sort of arms race to these low carbon products, whether it's UBS or Xtrackers coming out with their own versions of the MSCI SRI products. And then that's where we are today. And I guess what's the question mark going forward? If we've talked about the governance aspects, you know, if we've talked about the environmental aspects when it comes to low carbon or perhaps climate change oriented funds, I suppose it's the S that's going to be perhaps next. I mean, this is speculation, but I would imagine that there's going to be an increased focus going forward on how companies interact with the, you know, with the societies that they operate in, how do they treat their employees? Because I'm sure that these things are also a business risks that, you know, I think the passive space still needs to address. I think the act, I think this is where passive is perhaps behind active, as, you know, as far as broad ESG goes, considering the business risk around the S in ESG.
And I suppose you also have the classic criticism of around engagement. And where the kind of passive firms are voting and, you know, putting pressure on companies and that kind of thing. And you can't really exclude, well, you can to an extent, but you can't exclude things in a way an active fund manager can.
So I think the issue with the engagement for passives is this. Yes, passive managers or, you know, passive product providers can aggregate their shares and vote how they wish to. But at the end of the day, because it's a index oriented strategy, are you going to divest if a company you engage with doesn't necessarily, you know, follow through or agree? No, you can't, because it's passive. I think as far as engagement goes, it's definitely active managers who have more scope to vote with their feet. I think that's something to bear in mind.
And you mentioned SFDR. I mean, for people who aren't aware, what is that and what impact might that have?
Sure. So SFDR, the Sustainable Finance Disclosure Regulations, you know, in a nutshell, this is increased disclosure requirements for funds domiciled in Europe. This will mainly focus around what they call principal adverse impacts, or, you know, features of an investment that are set to have an adverse impact on I suppose the climate, if you will, you know, this could be information around CO2 outputs of your end portfolio, you know, water usage. In terms of a regulatory headache, I think a lot of asset managers were already moving this way. I think the demand for it was already sort of coming before the regulations came in. I think it's going to help investors who are quite serious about their own or their clients' ESG requirements to differentiate between funds. And I mean, you have to take a step back and look at the ultimate philosophy of these kinds of regulations. You know, I suppose they're quite clear in their assumptions that, you know, there is a larger threat to the climate. We are going to act on this. And what we're going to do is we're going to use financial markets to effectively reward or punish certain companies by, you know, using regulation to aid capital flows to them or away from them.
Yeah. So another push perhaps towards...
Yeah, SFDR is just another... Your step in that direction, yes.
And moving on from ESG, I suppose there's some kind of interesting other new developments in the space. One thing that's been talked about a bit this year, again, influenced by ARK and the kind of long shadow of Cathie Wood, is the idea of active ETFs. I mean, that's pretty nascent thing in the UK, and we don't yet have kind of the ability of ETFs in Europe to, I suppose, go only semi-transparent in terms of what they disclose. Do you guys think active ETFs are a thing coming to the UK and to Europe?
Within Europe, investors tend to prefer the fund structure of an active fund over an ETF. And partly this has been because within Europe, some funds are still paying commission, because we don't have that in the UK. So they tend to, you know, keep investing in those funds. For the US, the active funds have become very popular, but they've got a different structure to their ETF wrapper, which is more tax efficient than their mutual fund structure. So you've seen a lot more focus towards that. You've also seen a lot of the larger institutional providers of these funds switching from mutual funds into active ETFs because of the tax structure as well. So not only have we seen it more popular because there's been new issues out like ARK, we're also seeing it more popular because existing issuers of mutual funds are moving towards that way, which is less likely to be so in Europe. I think we will see more active funds. In HAN ETFs launched one today, on carbon. So I think it is something we'll see, but probably not as quickly as what we've seen the development in the US.
I suppose at the minute you have the difficulty that ETFs here still have to do significant disclosure of their holdings, which active managers aren't always particularly keen on. Mm-hmm. I mean, go on.
No, sorry, I was just going to say that I would absolutely echo Lynn's thoughts there. As you said, I think that, you know, the disclosure is too much of a headwind. I suppose what I could see, you know, as a workaround is you've had these fund launches from the likes of JP Morgan and Goldman Sachs, who are sort of late entrants into the ETF game. They've come in and they've seen a saturated market, and what they decided to do is find a way to leverage their active specialties and create what are effectively called research enhanced products. So JPM called theirs a research enhanced, and I think Goldman Sachs called theirs active beta. But effectively what it is it's a factor portfolio where one of the factors is an active analyst input, which helps to dictate weightings. And I suppose that's one way to try and leverage their active specialty, but with the benefits of an ETF wrapper. But beyond that, you know, with respect to, you know, seeing a fully fledged active ETF in Europe, I think it'll be hard. I think there are a lot of headwinds.
I guess I do find myself asking whether it would be that big a deal for UK investors. I mean, I guess the main issue I can actually think of is it might just make ETF due diligence a bit more confusing, because you're then having this kind of, you know, generally people view ETFs as a kind of passive or smart beta only kind of option. Does it just kind of muddy the waters?
Yeah, I would imagine so. I think it would be probably like a path of least resistance type thing again, where, you know, why don't I just stick with open-ended? If I am going to go the exchange traded, you know, let me stick to what I know, especially in the UK where there's a preference for investment trusts if you are going to play around with exchange traded products.
I mean, there's definitely benefits for an ETF wrapper over a mutual fund. You can trade on the secondary market, and therefore the trading spreads, the bid and offer spreads, can be much narrower, particularly if you're buying a UK equity ETF wrapper versus a mutual fund ETF fund, equity fund. So with an equity where you're paying the 0.5 stamp duty for UK equities, in the fund structure, you'll always pay that. So your spreads can be 60 to 80 bips wide. For an ETF tracking UK equities, whether it's active or whether it's passive, the spreads can be between 5 and 10 bips. So there are advantages for the ETF wrapper over the fund wrapper. It would just, you know, a lot further behind than the US in Europe on this, I'd say.
Yeah. It seems like they're much further ahead than us. And I suppose one last thing is just, we've talked about active, but there is also the so-called smart beta, focusing on factors like value. And those funds have perhaps become a bit more topical given the, we've seen bit of a market rotation going on since the vaccine news of November. But I suppose what's interesting as well is we've actually seen a bit of a contraction of that space. So Vanguard did have four factor ETFs, one of which was on our top 50 ETFs list last year. Of course, we're forced to change that because they then closed the range earlier this year. Do we think kind of smart beta products are going to last? Are they kind of dwindling as people focus on, you know, pure passives and thematics and all that kind of thing? Or is there a future for them still?
I think there's a future for them. I think some could be updated. So particularly for a dividend factor ETF, you know, a lot of them are still focusing more on equities that are, so selection of equities that are just paying a high dividend. Now, we've seen this run into problems last year when companies were either suspending or stopping their dividends. And these high dividend distribution ETFs that investors had invested in for specifically the dividend dropped by maybe 3 or 4% annual yields over the year. So, you know, if you are looking for anything factor, again, do your due diligence, look into exactly what they're looking for. There are dividend ETFs there that look fundamentals, so more of a quality push. And then there's also dividend ETFs, so the Spider Aristocrats, that say they're focusing on quality, but they've got a long spectrum of where companies need to pay dividends for consistently 20 years. So in that respect, you're losing out on some of the newer issued companies like tech. So you'll have a lower position in your tech sector and maybe a much higher position in financials and utilities. So you'll be tilted towards different sectors as well. So again, it's about doing your due diligence and making sure it's what you're expecting to see from that smart beta or factor range.
Yeah. And then interesting note on Vanguard, you know, we spoke to them earlier this year, and when they shut their range, you know, of the four funds, it was actually the value one did the best. I think it closed at over 150 million and the other three were sort of under 100. So for them, it was a question of scale. And I think sometimes, you know, with the question of you know, continuity of strategic beta funds and whether or not they're still relevant, I think a lot of asset managers, when it comes to their closures, they're really looking at scale. I think one of the headwinds for strategic beta sometimes is the methodology. I think sometimes investors can have a hard time actually understanding what goes on under the hood of these funds. I think sometimes it can be a bit of a black box approach, especially when you're combining, you know, multiple factors, like a multi-factor strategy. it's not clear when and how these factors interact. Are they washing each other out? Is it dynamic? How does the optimizer work? I think that can sometimes, you know, work against the popularity of these funds. I also think sometimes, you know, for single factor funds, surprisingly, they can sometimes not be the best way to gain exposure to these factors. I mean, take for example, like a typical, I don't know, a value factor of ETF. You'd be surprised how some of these index providers work. I mean, take MSCI. They will take the entire universe. They will give every stock a price to book, and they will cut it in half, literally, and say the bottom half of that is what we call value, and that's what will go into the value in value index. And so unless an investor looks into the methodology and scours through the finer details, they won't necessarily realize that actually this probably isn't the best way. Maybe I should be looking at a value-weighted alternative instead. And I think these are some of the challenges that face strategic beta at the moment.
Sorry, Liam. Go
on. I was just going to say, on the issue with Vanguard closing theirs, I feel that part of the reason that they closed is they're not very, they were active ETFs, but they're not very active in marketing their products, Vanguard, I'd say, in Europe. So they've been very sleepy in terms of marketing their products. And that's been one of the reasons maybe that they haven't had much AUM in them. They tend to be more focused towards the IFA market, and they do a lot of education towards that market. But in general, you know, you don't see lots of advertisements for Vanguard funds and what they're trying to do, unlike iShares and a couple of the others that do put out weekly information on their funds. And Spider is another one. So I think they've been quite sleepy, which has been part of the problem.
Maybe they're busy eating the multi-asset market with their life strategy range.
Maybe they are. Yeah.
So lots to think about there. But for now, we're unfortunately out of time. Huge thanks to both my guests, both for coming on today and for your help with the top 50 ETF list. Please do check our latest list in the magazine of the 9th of July or online. We'll also soon be publishing a piece looking at the thematic ETFs that excited our panel the most this year and keeping up all our regular coverage of the big issues in the ETF space. Thank you very much for listening and take care.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.